WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Friday, I have missed you. And you know what that means. It's time to recap the biggest stories of the week with some friends. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
Donald Trump will not have the cooperation of the Chicago Police Department if he chooses to target Chicago.
I'm glad the City Council stood by our welcoming city status today and reaffirmed our commitment to our immigrant communities.
CTA President Dorval Carter retiring at the end of this month.
Riders say they are fed up with the CTA in terms of crime, cleanliness, and timeliness, especially after the pandemic.
This job can be very difficult, but the challenges that I faced have been eclipsed by the opportunity to work with a group of professionals who are among the best in our industry.
As you just heard, there was a lot that happened this week. And I know Inauguration Day is just around the corner, but we can't forget about the local, national, and international news that broke. You know the drill. We brought on a few local journalists to help us make sense of the headlines, starting with our colleague Mariah Wolfel, city government and politics reporter for WBEZ, Daniel Knowles, Midwest correspondent for The Economist, and A.D. Quigg, Cook County and Chicago government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Mariah jumped right in to tell us more about some attempts to change Chicago's welcoming city ordinance.
Yeah, so that amendment failed by a vote of 39-11, essentially failed. The council didn't outright vote this proposal down. They voted to lay it on the table, which essentially prevents debate from happening on the ordinance at all and makes it hard to resurrect. The alderwoman who called for that vote on to lay this motion on the table says that it sends a clear message that this city council doesn't even want to entertain a debate on changing the city's sanctuary city status, which largely prohibits Chicago police from helping with immigration enforcement. This proposal would have allowed police to do that in certain instances when someone is arrested for certain crimes that are, according to the ordinance, drug-related, prostitution-related, gang-related, or sex crimes involving a minor.
Okay.
But this proposal was met with pretty broad pushback, including from the state's attorney general's office, Chicago Police Department itself, immigration advocates, of course, all of them kind of saying that it was rife with some legal, well, you know, most people saying it was rife with legal contradictions and could have violated state law that prevents in almost every circumstance local law enforcement from cooperating with agencies like ICE.
Let's hear from one of the measure's supporters. This is 23rd Ward Alder Savannah Tabaras.
These immigrant advocates, they don't want to solve the problem. They want to, it fuels their narrative and capacity to fundraise. And so they profit on fear.
Talk more about the scene at City Hall on Wednesday, AD. I mean, did immigrant rights activists show up?
Yeah. And it's a very charged issue that I don't think is going away just because of this vote. And we do have kind of like a progressive moderate split in the council about how to approach this that obviously we've seen play out in the migrant funding crisis. But yeah, people were activated. It was one of those days at council where it's like kind of buzzing.
Yeah. And while people say like, you know, this one page ordinance, you know, maybe had a lot of legal contradictions, it's not that that every single person who voted to lay it on the table doesn't want to see tweaks to the sanctuary city ordinance at all. It's just that this wasn't the proposal that was going to get them there.
This was not the way. Now, alders were also supposed to vote on lowering the speed limit throughout the city, but that effort stalled. Daniel, what happened?
Well, it's still, I gather they had voted to have some sort of study into it. So maybe it'll resurrect.
Needs more work.
Yeah. I mean, lowering speed limits is not very popular, or at least not with drivers. I know that there's something that Daniel Lasparta has been pushing for a long time, and he's, you know, he's actually my alderman, not that I get to vote, but he's my alderman, you know, and he's we have wonderful new bike lanes in Wicker Park that have kind of spread up and down it. And the facts, the kind of argument for it is basically, you know, the 130 or so traffic deaths a year in this city, and at a lower speed, the chance of being killed by being hit by a car just falls. It actually falls with the square of the speed. So you're sort of four or five times less likely to die if you're hit by a car doing 30 compared to 40, and, you know, same again at 20. So the kind of logic for it is pretty clear. There's also, counterintuitively, moves traffic faster if everybody drives slower. I think one of the worries is that, you know, maybe it won't be enforced, but we'll see if that ever happens.
Oh, the city of Chicago loves traffic enforcement. Are you kidding?
Good point.
Mariah, what do opponents of lowering the speed limit have to say? Tell us more.
Well, I think that they worry it's a cash grab that's going to, you know, impact lower income Chicagoans the most. Parking and speeding debt in the city disproportionately affects people in low income areas and mostly Black neighborhoods. You know, it's also fair to say, and the city's Department of Transportation is first to point this out, that Black Chicagoans are also 3.8 times more likely than other residents to be killed in a traffic crash. And so, you know, there's different arguments to be made, but there's no doubt that lowering the speed limit would generate more revenue for the city. If history is any indication, you know, WBEZ did an analysis of when the city lowered the threshold for automated speed camera tickets.
Yes.
In 2021. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Revenue
got a bunch
from
of tickets all of a sudden.
Yeah. And revenue skyrocketed, including
it
from your wallet. You know?
You're welcome.
And mine, probably. So that's the
but
main
it also,
point
it
of
also
concern.
Got me to straighten up, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Take what I was doing more seriously.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it's a matter of why don't we take a look at reforming, an equitable ticketing system before we lower this speed limit.
Well, and this is an attractive solution because it's virtually free for the city to do, aside from like changing signage and probably adjusting like what speed cameras we have. On the other side, creating like bump outs or like actual infrastructure is very expensive for the city to do and takes a lot of time. And usually you have to get like federal matching grants. It's a whole thing. So this seems extremely straightforward, but also has a lot of opponents just because people love their cars in Chicago. People hate their tickets in Chicago. And yes, our revenues have not really gone back to transit or safety measures. They've just basically gone to like closing budget holes historically.
And Daniel, plenty of other cities around the U.S. have done this, right? They have lowered the speed limit.
All over the place, yeah. In the UK as well, where I'm from, London, it's mostly like a 20-mile-an-hour zone now, which is controversial, but it's kind of worked. I think, you know, what AD was getting at with the bump outs to design, what one of the challenges with this as a measure is that people tend to drive at the speed that they feel safe at, and if the road is kind of wide and there aren't, you know, obstacles in it, people feel safe driving faster. And then if the speed limit is, you know, 25 miles an hour and it's this big wide road, people will go over it and then they'll feel aggrieved when they get a ticket. And it's quite hard, just literally psychologically hard to drive at a low speed on these big wide roads. So, you know, I think what your sort of traffic safety advocates would want is, you know, more than just changing the speed limit, is to change how the roads look, to make people feel safer driving, or rather make people drive slower sort of by default. But, you know, that is way harder, more expensive, and doesn't raise loads of revenue. So,
So after 10 years of heading up the CTA, it seems the constant criticism and complaints about Chicago's transit system may have finally derailed Dorval Carter.
Nice.
Yeah. He's stepping down at the end of this month. Daniel, walk us through some of the issues that people were having with him.
Well, I think the big problem, the reason why people have got very upset with Dorval Carter is that it's been years, you know, the whole time I've been living in the city, certainly 3.5 years, where CTA service has not been up to scratch. People tell me how wonderful it was before the pandemic, and I can only imagine, but it's, you know, but the the service is less than what's timetabled. You know, they have these big gaps, and kind of CTA leadership has just continually sort of stonewalled whenever they're asked about this, you know, refused to come to talk for the city council until they've been forced to. So Dorval has sort of gradually lost just, you know, support across the board, essentially. And we have reached this point where there's this huge deficit in public transport funding, you know, not only the CTA, across the whole sort of all three agencies, that's going to have to be filled by the end of the year because this pandemic money that has kept it afloat is running out. Mm-hmm. There's proposals in Springfield to, you know, to kind of unify all the different transit agencies in the Chicago region, mm-hmm. and which is something that Carter opposed. And so I think essentially it's just reached a point where he sort of had to go. Mm.
Mayor Johnson always did seem to be in support of Carter, Mariah. I mean, has that changed?
Yeah, a lot of people thought that, you know, firing Carter earlier than would have been a pretty easy political win for Johnson because he was facing pressure to do
so. There were so many calls for it.
From nearly every direction, unless you're looking in Carter's direction, you know. Springfield lawmakers, City Hall, you know, the governor wanted a change in leadership at the CTA. So if I had to bet, I would say it wasn't entirely Carter's decision to leave, especially when you see someone retire as they announce they're taking a new CEO position. You have to wonder.
Yeah. So where is he going? He's going to head.
He's going to be the CEO of St. Anthony's Hospital.
Okay. So that's the new gig.
He has some connections to, I think his dad was a doctor there, and he was on the board of St. Anthony's Hospital. But, you know, I think that Johnson did give him the grace to announce his retirement when he wanted to. He did so the Friday after, you know, kind of tying the final ribbon on federal funding for the long promised southbound extension of the Red Line. Mm-hmm. You know, Carter was crying at the news conference. So he did get that chance to secure what will be a major part of his legacy.
Yeah.
And that is like a very fitting end for him because the big bonus or like his main selling point was that he was very good at getting federal money.
I mean, this is a 40-year career in public transportation that we're talking about that's coming to an end. What do you think his legacy will be, AD?
People are going to remember the Red Line extension. I think people are also going to remember some of the, I mean, I'm going to remember transit TIFs, the creation of special taxing districts to fund transit going forward. So the RPM, the redo of like all of the overpasses of the red and purple and brown lines near mm-hmm. Belmont, like that was a big deal. That's changed quite a bit. Hopefully, in the years to come, we will see a completed legacy of ADA updates to train stations around the city. That is still, I can't believe how big of a problem that remains. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, because he ended on this Red Line note, like getting it right under the wire before Trump came in, like, that's going to be a big one.
That's a big one. Now, what do you think his legacy will be, Daniel?
I think he's actually a really interesting case study in terms of, you know, American public transport, because it's exactly as AD just said, and he got this huge investment in for capital projects, but you can see a whole bunch of kind of routine stuff sort of falling behind. You know, the amount of slow zones on L-track is the highest it's ever been, and so that means that your train's going slower. That means that they're moving around, less quickly, which means that you have to wait longer for trains.
Right.
There's still this kind of shortage of staffing. So, you know, I imagine that kind of, in terms of the picking of a replacement, that certainly, if I were in charge, what I'd be thinking about is the operational side. And mm-hmm. this is a big problem in general, you know, kind of public transport in America, is that there's often this federal funding for capital money, these huge pots of money, no more so than recently with the Infrastructure Act, which means that, you know, you have an incentive to get somebody who can go and get that federal money. But in terms of like operations, that's not the priority. And so you get these same gaps. I mean, you know, you see in New York City with the MTA, they're finally beginning to fix this with congestion pricing, but look how long it took.
Right. Well, you mentioned replacement there, Daniel. Who's going to be heading up the CTA after his resignation at the end of this month?
Well, for now, it's his chief of staff,
Nora Learson.
Exactly. Yes, you're better remembering names than me. But I have no idea who the kind of long run person that they will pick.
No one so hearing gossip? Really? I'm looking at you, ladies.
I'm not like deep in the national transit community
circles.
Gossip. Yeah. But that's, again, that's been like one of the main reasons people say, we couldn't get rid of Dorval Carter was because he was like so uniquely, there aren't that many people that have run huge transit systems in the country. It's a big job.
His salary has come under a lot of scrutiny as well in the last few years. It's almost $400,000, which is nearly twice the mayor's salary. Will that interim president, will she be making that same amount?
No, I think it'll be like $100,000 less. I think the CTA board approved something in the ballpark of $270,000 for her interim salary, and it's unclear how long she'll be serving that role.
Surprise! We had another colleague of ours, Chicago Sun-Times federal court reporter John Seidel, join the mix to give us the latest updates on former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan's corruption case. Now, this week, the defense rested its case after calling 12 witnesses, including Madigan. John broke down what he had to say this week.
He had a lot to say. I mean, this week in particular, he faced off with the lead prosecutor who's been in charge of this investigation, my understanding, from pretty much the word go.
Okay.
So that was a big moment. But, you know, Madigan spent 4 days on the witness stand, nearly 12 hours of testimony. And, of course, he started with questions from his own defense attorney, and he tried to connect with the jurors, told them a little bit about his own personal story, and also gave an explanation from his perspective as to what was going on mm-hmm. here. We finally heard his side of the story, right, directly from him. But then he was challenged by the prosecutor this week about some of what was going on, especially when it came to Danny Solis. But Madigan's testimony also opened the door to some new recordings that the jurors hadn't heard yet, including one where Madigan laughs about people making out like bandits when it comes to making a lot of money and not doing a lot of
work.
Defense attorneys do not like that recording because they say the person he's talking about wasn't part of this scheme, but jurors have heard it.
Oh, my goodness. So, I mean, you've been sitting in court all day, every day, John. Anything stand out to you from the defense's case?
Well, yeah. Again, I think the alternative narratives, the Madigan side of the story, I think it's important that he delivered that to the jury and that they heard it directly from him. I think that's important. I don't think there was a way for the defense to do that without putting Madigan on the stand. So I think that's important. I think it's also notable that Madigan is you know, he's always closely guarded his private life.
Yes.
And he really had to expose some of that to talk to the jury. He talked about his upbringing and working for his father in the Department of Streets and Sand and explained how his father was an alcoholic and confrontations that he'd have with his father and how he learned to avoid confrontation. The reason that matters is because part of the defense theory is that Madigan liked to avoid confrontation. Mm-hmm. And I think that specifically comes into play with Danny Solis, the former Chicago alderman who flipped and recorded him for the FBI.
Right.
There's a moment, in fact, when Madigan said that he did not want to further confront Solis. So that's why that matters. But the prosecution really kind of hammered away at the fact that there was this moment when Danny Solis dropped the words quid pro quo mm-hmm. into a conversation tying approvals at City Hall to business for Madigan's law firm. Madigan wound up lecturing him about using those words later, but Madigan kept dealing with Solis and talking with Solis, even though Solis continued to kind of try and make these connections. And ultimately, as part of a FBI ruse, Solis asked for Madigan's help getting a spot on a paid government board, mm-hmm. a state board, and Madigan agreed to help. And the prosecutor made that point, even after the quid pro quo comment, which Madigan said gave him a great deal of concern. Madigan kept talking to Solis and was even willing to recommend him for a board.
Boy, how did the jury respond, do you think, to the different witnesses that the defense was calling up?
I think this jury has been really engaged when it comes to all of the witnesses, right? Like they're paying attention. They've been in this for a really long time. The presidential election hadn't even happened when they started hearing testimony. So they're in this. They're taking lots of notes. When it came to Madigan, I remember seeing one juror just leaning forward, elbows on the knees, like, okay, tell me the story, man.
Wow. You know, really interested.
Yeah. I saw some scrunched up faces when Madigan was talking about Solis. Again, I keep pointing to that. But, you know, overall, I don't know. They're very engaged. They're taking notes. Generally, not sure what to make of their reactions, but there was that one.
Yeah. Speaking of engaged, anybody else on the panel been engaged so far in this trial? Have you been following it all?
I have almost been avoiding it because I'm afraid it's like jumping into a really complicated TV show in like episode 7.
Mid-season.
Yeah. It's like, yeah. I watched the first season. I know a lot of these characters, but like,
right.
what's the reference to this?
Just completely lost the plot, right?
Right.
I mean, like, there was like jury instruction week, very complicated, like, I feel for the jurors.
Yeah, you,
and I'm glad to know
you
that
sat this one out.
Yeah, paying very close attention.
Yeah. Are you expecting closing arguments to start next week, John?
Yeah, Wednesday is attorneys are going to come in on Tuesday after the holiday, hammer out some last jury instructions. And then, yeah, the judge told them it's going to be closings, final instructions, and then it's finally time to deliberate.
Any rough estimate as to when we can expect that to happen?
To deliberate?
Yeah.
Probably roughly January 27th. They're expecting 3 days of closing arguments. But the judge also said he's not putting any time limits on that. This trial has been... Remember, we were talking about this ending in mid-December, right? So it's been hard to really pinpoint the timeline in this trial.
True.
So that's how it's looking now.
That's John Seidel, a federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
All right, we'll switch gears now and talk about the first ever elected school board members who were sworn in on Wednesday. Mariah, what were some of the issues that they're going to have to deal with right off the bat?
Well... what do we choose from to talk about?
Give me the quick version.
There's a lot of them. I mean, the big one, I think, is the teacher's contract right now that is in negotiations. A lot of focus has been paid to, the economic portions of this contract proposal. Teachers are looking for raises. You know, you've heard a lot about Mayor Brandon Johnson wanting to take out a loan to help cover those raises, plus, you know, help make up for this fiscal cliff that the district is facing. And then there's also... the non-economic parts of the teacher's contract proposal that my colleague Sarah Karp and Nader Issa did a deep dive on this week. You know, some of those have to do with school planning time. So for example, up until 2012, Chicago teachers were paid to arrive to school 30 minutes early, and they would use that time to, you know, prepare their instruction for the day, collaborate with other teachers. In 2012, Mayor Rahm Emanuel decided to get rid of that because he wanted Chicago to no longer have one of the shortest instruction days in the country. And so part of that was closing that gap and putting it towards instruction in the classroom. And so that has kind of been a sticking point in contract negotiations ever since, trying to get back that extra preparatory paid time so that teachers don't have to do it on their own. Another one is, you know, who has the final say over what's taught in classrooms. So they have a lot on their plate, to mention, having at some point going to have to approve a new CEO once Pedro Martinez steps down from
the role.
That's
right.
Remember?
Remember that Friday news dump from how many weeks ago? So the mayor gets to appoint 11 of the 21 board members. We're still waiting for him to name that 11th board member, right?
Yeah. So 20 of 21 were, inaugurated on this week on Wednesday. The CTA board, the city council, and the CPS board met on Wednesday.
Oh my God.
So it was a big day. So 10 were elected, 10 are appointed by the mayor.
Yeah.
We're waiting on one, and they all got sworn in.
Yeah, so the teachers union, AD, they had hoped to have a new contract by the time that these elected board members arrived. I mean, any indication that they seem any closer to finalizing?
There were a lot of blown deadlines that the union has set along the way. But as far as how long these contracts take to negotiate, we're not quite to like the lengths that previous contracts. I think we were at like 10 months and some of the other ones took 14 or 17.
That sounds right.
You know, we had some strikes in between.
casual strikes.
The impression that I've got from the people that are talking is, like Mariah said, most of the unresolved stuff is not economic. It is like workplace fixes, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But those are very complicated to implement. And I don't think Pedro Martinez wants to risk making the school day appear or be shorter either.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're going to wait till the very, very end of Pedro Martinez's time on the time at CPS to like wait to approve a contract. But it seems closer than it did in December.
Yeah. Like, I think the CTU has just recently gone down on its, I mean, we're talking about how a lot of it's non-economic, but has just lowered its raise proposal to be more closely aligned with the district.
We started at 9%, we're down to
I think 5% in the first couple of years. But in the out years, I think that's gets a little bit stickier with how CPS envisions it. So I think they are getting closer on some things, but...
So these tense talks are going on, and the head of the teachers union is coming under a lot of scrutiny for a pretty controversial comment, Mariah. What did she say?
There wasn't enough going on. So,
right.
the CTU president, Stacey Davis Gates, apparently compared CEO Pedro Martinez to a special education student who can't be suspended. And this was at a meeting before hundreds of elected members. She apologized at the meeting soon after she made the comment. And Sarah Karp, our education reporter, says that there are slightly different accounts online of her comment. But two delegates who Sarah interviewed said she, you know, Davis Gates disparaged Martinez by calling him a student with, and this isn't direct quotes, but a student with disabilities that couldn't be suspended because of policy limitations.
Ooh.
Not great, because, you know, there are a lot of issues with resources for special education students. And
it's been under-resourced
yes,
for many years.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's not great to have the president of the CTU saying that.
Not a good look. All right, AD, the Civic Federation weighed in on CPS's budget this week. What were the main takeaways?
It's bad.
Mm-hmm. We ain't got no money?
Yeah. So as we know, we have like triplicate budget. Everyone has budget problems right now.
Right.
For mostly the same reasons. They're running out of COVID funds that were like plugging holes that existed pre-COVID. Civic Fed has always felt that CPS should do a better job aligning actual spending and staffing with the money that it had. The union has disagreed with this, and Pedro Martinez has made comments to this effect too, that actually having all this COVID money showed how much better the district could do and how much better students could perform if they had more money.
Mm-hmm.
But they are going to be bumping up against a massive deficit next year, no matter what fixes they come up with this year to pay for the contract. $500 million next year, more than that afterwards. Springfield also projected to have a $3 billion deficit, so CTU's calls repeatedly is that they need more state funding, and that seems less and less likely given the state's own budget constraints, transit agencies knocking on the door for more money, the city of Chicago knocking on the door for more money, not to mention all of the other governments around
mm-hmm.
the state. So their warning is basically you increased staffing, you increased salaries, you're not closing school buildings that are vastly underutilized. Things are about to get very, very real for you, and you should take them seriously as soon as possible.
And the teachers' union reacted to this report how?
Basically by saying that the Civic Federation has always said this and that there is money in the city of Chicago. The answer is revenue, essentially. They're saying the answer is not cuts, the answer is revenue, and the city has enough wealth in it to afford it.
Well, I'm going to turn now to another budgetary issue that, AD, I'm going to get you to break it down. And Daniel, I'd love for you to sort of weigh in here. But S&P downgraded Chicago's credit rating this week. Give us the details, AD.
Yes. So we had been waiting for this because S&P, during the mayor's budget, essentially put the city on credit watch because they were very concerned that this massive budget hole, they had a $1 billion budget hole to fix. They were concerned that too much of that hole was going to be filled with non-recurring revenues, so like one shots. So, and it was. So we had TIF revenues, we had leftover ARPA money, a bunch of other little tiny fixes.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mayor Johnson made his initial proposal, obviously he had that $300 million property tax increase. Council did away with that, which ratings agencies hate. They love it when we raise property taxes because it means we, in good faith, are going to pay off our debts. And when they didn't do that, or as they started chipping away from that property tax number, all the ratings agencies got kind of freaked out. Moody's, which already has the city one notch above junk, which is kind of explains everything. When you're a junk, people don't want to invest in you and you have to pay way more in interest. They kept the city where it was. So they were like, you're pretty close to the edge. We're just going to keep you there. S&P had them slightly higher and came out this week and basically said, you don't have enough structural solutions in here. We're going to knock you down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We are still waiting to see if one of the other major ratings agencies, Fitch, does anything. They have the city higher up above that junk rating, but we assume, and we tried to ask the city CFO what kind of impact this would have on the cost of borrowing going
right.
forward. And she was like, it's somewhat minor, but she didn't have like an exact number. And we know the city's going out to borrow relatively soon. They're asking for $830 million in general obligation bonds to do a lot of like infrastructure work. They do this regularly,
mm-hmm.
but I'm very interested to see what the interest rates are.
I am so glad you broke that down because I saw the BBB rating and
yeah.
I was like, what is that?
I had to draw myself a little picture and highlight where the city was
right.
relative
no,
to
No, your
to
story
junk.
Was fantastic. How significant, though, do you think that something like this is for the city, Daniel?
Oh, it's big. Chicago's already spending, I think I'm right in this, something like 40% of its tax revenue goes on pensions and debt.
AD is nodding.
I'm nodding.
Yeah, it's a huge amount. And the number of pensioners is only going to grow over time. So it's this big problem for the city of Chicago. It's a big problem for the state of Illinois. Not as big a problem for the state. I think they've got a bit more of a handle on it, but it is. And that is money that you have to raise from your residents that you can't spend on services. And, you know, for the last 3 years, the property tax in real terms has fallen. You know, it's been kept in dollar terms the same. So it's really difficult to raise taxes any other way. You know, you could put an income tax on at a state level. You could raise the income tax, perhaps. But, you know, you need these broad-based taxes. And the city is very addicted to kind of, you know, one-off shots and then trying to raise taxes an awful lot on a small number of people. Because.
Right.
And that's really hard to do. At some point, you just have to say to your kind of residents, we need more taxes. The other thing you can do that I'm surprised that fewer politicians in this region aren't talking about, one who is Cam Buckner, has made a big deal of this, is you need to grow the population. If you grow the population, you spread that tax burden among a smaller number. And if I were, you know, that's what my advice would be.
That was a goal that Lori Lightfoot set pre-COVID, right. And then COVID happened.
You know, and it's not just the city and the schools that are in financial straits, as you sort of alluded to there, Daniel, that the state's facing more than a $3 billion deficit. The Regional Transit Authority proposed a plan to help the state and public transit get back on track fiscally. What's the idea there, Daniel?
Sorry, say that again.
The RTA's plan.
Oh, the RTA. Yeah, so the, you know, again, there's this huge deficit, COVID-related. Ridership isn't back up, so fare revenue isn't back up, and also the fares haven't been put up on the trains. So the proposal is, you know, obviously the state is going to have to bail this out. So I think one of the ways this will happen is via raising the sales tax on services. There's some other proposals too, but the kind of thing that the state's looking for, rather, you know, that this law that's going through Springfield would do, is to unify the three transit agencies, PACE, METRA, and the CTA, into one as a sort of, and create a new kind of governance structure.
And what's the likelihood, you think, that lawmakers would give the RTA more authority over the various public transit agencies?
It feels more and more likely to me that that's going to happen. Okay. I feel like the person who would be opposed to this is the mayor, and the mayor is very unpopular and kind of absent. So, you know, the governor seems more open to it. I think it's hard to say exactly what will happen, but I think something like this will happen.
Yeah. AD, the chief of the CTA, Dorval Carter, who we just spoke about, I mean, he was always against the idea of merging the area's transit agencies.
Oh, no one wants less power.
Yeah, and now he's leaving. He's retiring. Do you think the next head of the CTA might feel differently?
I mean, it's up to Mayor Brandon Johnson to choose the person that aligns with his vision.
I was
vision.
Just going to say, someone who thinks the way he does.
Yeah, but again, to the mayor's detriment, he does not have a huge Springfield lobbying team right now. That's been an issue almost from the jump. I know they're trying to beef up again now, but let's say he did get a CEO who was anti-merge.
Yeah.
Who does he have down there to really push that agenda versus, you know, RTA and all the other elected officials who do want a merger? Among them is Tony Preckwinkle, who this week was like, we could have coordinated schedules. We could have one card to get you on all these separate, you could get anywhere better and more efficiently. And who doesn't want that?
Yeah. Daniel, you have looked at public transit all over the world, public transportation rather, all over the world. How do you think Chicago's transit system compares to other world-class cities?
Ooh.
I don't want to be too brutal about my adopted city.
Okay, just keep it brief. Maybe give me a letter grade. I think
Chicago
criticism is important for improvement.
I think Chicago has the bones of what could be a fantastic transport system, and there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that could make it run really, really well. It's kind of taking the wrong approach. And the Red Line extension, which, you know, it's good to have an extension, but it's a really good example of how some of these coordination issues come in. You have this electrified train line, the Metra Electric, that goes, you know, kind of through those neighborhoods or near them already, mm-hmm. and runs, you know, once every half an hour. And it's a whole separate ticketing system. And you could really improve some of that. You know, there's already some of that infrastructure in place, but no, we're going to have a fancy new $5.5 billion extension.
Yeah. So, you said you wouldn't be brutal.
Wait, what? I want to hear the other low-hanging fruit.
Oh, well, I mean, hiring more train drivers would be good. I think some of the things around, you know, there's lots of policies around parking and tolling, which could encourage people to use the trains more. I mean, again, just New York City's congestion pricing has been in operation for 2 weeks and everybody is already kind of saying how phenomenally well it's working. Mm-hmm. And I know it would be horribly unpopular. I know how people would take it here.
Oh,
I've
that's
read
not
the Tribune's
work here.
Editorials. But
we talked about it here on Reset too.
If you live in Illinois, have you ever considered becoming a Hoosier? Well, for folks not familiar, that is what people of our neighboring state of Indiana are called. Well, an Indiana bill is encouraging Illinois residents interested in seceding to join the Hoosier state. AD had that story.
If it means more people in Illinois are fans of Indiana football and basketball, I'm all for
it. So we can just leave?
Yeah, we just peace out. Say thanks. It's been a
moving to Indiana.
No. All this is very, very theoretical at this point and non-binding.
Okay.
A lot of constitutional changes would have to happen. And Governor Pritzker is very, very opposed to this. He called it a stunt that is not going to happen.
Okay.
What I haven't seen yet that I would like to see is what the state's boundaries would look like if these, it's mostly counties in southern Illinois, central Illinois. I want to know what the new state boundaries would look like if they did leave. Because I think both state boundaries, and I'm biased because I've lived in both of them, are so distinctive and wonderful.
Yes.
And ruining that would be a shame. But no, it's at this stage, there were about 30 counties who have taken non-binding votes in Illinois to explore leaving or leave. Most of them do not have home rule power, which means they're very non-sticky referendums. Mm-hmm. They don't have actual power. But the Indiana House has started touting this. And politically, it makes a lot of sense for them to do so because they want to come across as like the low tax, better state to be in. Because some of the problems that these southern and central counties have is that there's too much attention and deference given to what Chicago and Cook County want and not enough on rural communities. And the state of Indiana is saying, hey, we're good with this. Come on over.
Well, I want to hear from the horse's mouth here. You said Pritzker is not a fan, but let's hear him tell us.
Well, it's a stunt. It's not going to happen. But I'll just say that that Indiana is a low-wage state that doesn't protect workers, a state that does not provide health care for people when they're in need.
Oh, dear. The quote's even worse than I thought it was. So, I mean do you think this Indiana legislation could actually pass?
Yeah.
And if passed, this commission, it would actually start looking into how to change the boundaries?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think politically it would be like a very popular move in Indiana to pull off. And I believe they have a supermajority of Republicans then in the Indiana House. So I think there's a good chance that passes, but how far it gets down the track.
Yeah.
To go back to the CEA analogies.
That's the
question. It's an open question.
So let's look ahead to Donald Trump's inauguration on Monday. Cubs owner Todd Ricketts is teaming up with other sports owners and Mark Zuckerberg to host an inaugural reception. Dan, do they have all these inaugural festivities in Britain every time that there's a new prime minister? I'm curious.
we have them when we get a new monarch. We call it coronation. Oh. And I feel like that might be what Donald Trump is hoping for. No, not when we get a new prime minister, which in the last 10 years is a blessing because we've had rather
a few
of them.
I had a feeling that it wasn't as big of a, you know, all the fanfare. But for those who don't know, AD, billionaire Cubs owner Todd Ricketts is a big Republican donor.
Correct.
And activist, right?
Right.
Wow. Okay. Well, what about the massive inaugural contributions that we've been seeing from tech and other business leaders around the country? President Biden warned of an oligarchy taking shape in America. What's the economist saying about how money's influencing politics here?
Oh, we're very worried about it. I mean, this is what, when we wrote our endorsement of Kamala Harris in November, that you know, one of the things we were most worried about is basically just this kind of orgy of corruption that seems to be happening around around the incoming president. I mean, yeah, gosh, I hope that doesn't, I think that's fine. And You know, I mean, before I worked here, you know, my previous job, I worked in Africa and in India as well. And you see this sort of, you know, what a lot of academics are talking about at the moment is this kind of sort of partial democracy, this type of corrupt democracy where, mm-hmm. where you have votes, you have, you have elections, but you have extraordinary sums of money being traded for sort of favors. You know, this is what's happened in Hungary under the prime minister there, who Viktor Orban, who is incredibly popular among sort of Trump and others. So there's certainly people kind of fearful that, you know, you get this kind of, you play with the person in power, you give him money, you pay homage, or you get screwed. That's the sort of, I guess, what we're worried about.
Yeah, as Washington prepares for Monday's inauguration, people are still being sentenced for their role in the January 6th attack in 2021. That includes a 38-year-old man from downstate Illinois, sentenced this week to nearly a year in prison and a more than $43,000 fine. That's for breaking a window of the Capitol with his flag pole. All right, switching gears to a couple of wild stories that I just have to get to, you know. Chilean flamingo and harbor seal died unexpectedly at the Lincoln Park Zoo. Officials think bird flu is the cause here. And so this is, of course, sad news for the zoo. But officials are stressing visitors to the zoo are not at risk of catching bird flu. So it should not keep any of us away from visiting the other animals. Although I think, I don't know, I may wait till the temperatures are above single digits. We've got another cold front coming, right? Isn't it supposed to be super freezing?
I got an iced coffee today because it's going to be 45 degrees.
Crazy. Is that what you're drinking over there? Degrees. An iced coffee. This woman is insane.
Practically spring.
Well, here's something else that's insane. It was coyote chaos throughout Chicagoland. One showed up in the Humboldt Park Aldi. Another got hit on an O'Hare runway, causing a United flight to turn around after takeoff. And a tragic story from the southwest neighborhood of Mount Greenwood, where police are investigating a beating of a coyote pup by three teenagers. Oh my goodness. First of all, why so many coyote stories? And that is horrific, that last one.
Yeah, it started out like kind of cute with this coyote running into Aldi.
Like, oh wow.
Like the picture of him is so cute and he looks so snuggly.
It's a very handsome.
But to chase and eat one, like what did it do to you?
Yeah, God, and terrible. In the southwest side story case, this was like a coyote family that had kind of been hanging out in the neighborhood, which makes it even more upsetting. It wasn't like people saw a coyote and felt endangered and went after it for some reason. It was like, no, these are kind of cuties.
Well, they tend to be more active in the winter months, especially during mating season from January through March. So we may just see some more sightings of them in the coming weeks. In quick news here in local media, the Chicago Reader, the free weekly newspaper, announced it was laying off six employees as it faced, quote, imminent risk of closure. A lot of people, of course, can't imagine Chicago without its alternative paper. But clearly, it's I think, facing the same pressures that a lot of media outlets are facing. This feels like a headline among us, right, within our industry.
No, and we all know, all of us know people that work at the Reader. We all read the Reader. They are taking donations.
Yeah.
I strongly encourage folks to donate. If you want to get something back, they have a great store. They're hats, sweatshirts, mugs, backpacks. If you want something out of it, also shop there.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great idea. Two suburban stories here. There's scaffolding around the Will County Courthouse in Joliet. This is after a 90-pound tile off the exterior cement wall fell from the fifth or sixth floor of the building.
What?
Jeez. I know, that's insane.
I mean, the next story
90
is
when... 90 pounds.
What was it secured with?
Yeah, and...
Doesn't sound like much.
I can't imagine...
No one was hurt?
The county wasn't warned about the dangers of this 90-pound tile that...
There are other 90-pound tiles, I assume. Tiles work together.
Right.
There's multiple... Oh, wow.
No one was hurt, though, thankfully. In North Suburban Winnetka, the house that was made famous by the movie Home Alone, if you were listening earlier on WBEZ, it sold for, wait for it, $5.5 million.
Worth every penny.
It doesn't surprise me. I almost like...
It's a beautiful
house.
I think
it'd be more. Yeah, because of its house. You know, claim to fame, and it's huge.
I floated because I'm from South Bend, Indiana, so I have a deep association with the South Bend Shovel Slayer.
Oh, we know you're from Indiana.
Thank you very much.
That's why we make you our Indiana correspondent every time you're here.
If anyone else in the Chicagoland area from South Bend wants to get in on this with me. I want to buy the South Bend Shovel Slayer's house.
Ooh. Does that price tag, Daniel, does it change how you view the movie Home Alone?
It doesn't really. I would love to do a, you know, to work out what share of that is like the, you know, the sort of the Home Alone factor and how much is just kind of Winnetka property prices in general.
Macaulay Culkin said he thought about buying it.
Yeah, because like in the terms of other regions, you know, other parts of big cities in the United States, you know, if that were in California or in you know, outside New York City, I think that'd be a bargain.
Right. So, All right. Well, we will leave it there for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Daniel Knowles of The Economist, WBEZ's Mariah Wolfel, and A.D. Quigg of The Tribune. Enjoy your weekend, folks.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
This episode of The Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Micah Yasin. Reset provides you, our listeners, with the latest news and biggest stories that happen in and around the Chicago area. For more content like this, subscribe to our podcast. Also, if you like what we do, why don't you share our podcast with a friend? I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening, and take care.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.